This is Podtech.net for Wednesday, September 13th. I'm Matt Kelly in Los Angeles. It's day two of the CTIA Wireless IT and Entertainment Trade Show here at the LA Convention Center. The event kicked off today with a mobile entertainment roundtable discussion featuring three key leaders in the industries seeking to monetize the third screen: Hollywood, gaming, and wireless providers. The panelists covered a wide array of topics germane to the subject, including standards and practices and the recent Apple announcement, among others, and was moderated by Wall Street Journal personal technology columnist Walter Mossberg.
Well, good morning. And let me start by introducing the panel. Mitch Lasky is the Senior Vice President of EA Mobile, the famous games company. Michael Linton is the chairman and CEO of Sony Pictures Entertainment. And then Lowell McAdam is the executive vice president and chief operating officer of Verizon Wireless. So thank you all.
Thanks, Walt.
Let's start with something Peter Chernin just said, and I'd love to get your guys' take on it. You often can't find the entertainment products on your phone, and consumers get frustrated, and then when they do find it, they sometimes discover they can't play it on the particular phone they have. So Mitch, what's your reaction to that? Is he right?
I think he's generally right about that. I mean, I think we've been talking about for years the fact that content innovation has been happening at a much more rapid pace than shopping innovation. And we've still been left with, the 14 characters on the deck is our principal way of getting to the consumer. So, yeah, I would agree with him in general. I think, you know, we're working with Lowell and with other carriers on trying to improve that shopping experience, but I think there's a long way to go.
So, Michael, can you ever imagine attracting a kind of consumer loyalty to your entertainment on phones with the current kind of user interface for getting to it?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I agree with what Mitch is saying, that it's oftentimes difficult. I think that the experience, though, is spotty. I think there are certain services that I can go up on, and it's pretty easy. You know, I'm a subscriber to VCast, and I find it pretty easy to go into VCast and find what I want, whether it's the latest Jon Stewart clip or something from the news or something from sports or something like that. I've gone into other services, whether it's here in the United States or in Europe, and it's more difficult. I think the point that's perhaps as relevant that Peter was raising is that there's not a single standard. So depending upon where I am and whether I'm with a GSM provider, a CDMA provider, or whose deck I'm using, I'm not quite sure about which way to go.
So that's an interesting point, Lowell. What if somebody in this room came up with their competitive service to VCast and they wanted to offer it to people who happen to be subscribers to your network?
Well, the user interface has been the challenge, from whether it was the web originally on your PC or whether it's the mobile phone. And you know, we have invested a lot of resource because we think the number one barrier to customers adopting mobile media in a big way is how easy it is for them. So we spent the money to develop VCast, and frankly, we had to go to the OEMs and say, we feel so strongly about this, you have to put this on the device, and that wasn't easy. So our way around that was to standardize VCast. It does mean that you have to design to that standard if you're going to be at Verizon Wireless, but we think that that actually accelerates adoption versus having all these different interfaces that you have to put on a phone. The bottom line is there's not enough memory, operating system performance, or any of that on a phone to have multiple user interfaces. Just for the audience, Walt and I have an ongoing discussion. He refers to all the service providers as the Soviet ministries because we don't allow everything on the deck, but we are driven. Yeah. I knew they were out there, Walt. We might as well recognize them from the beginning.
Well, it's my term, Soviet ministries, is a slightly more delicate term than Steve Jobs' term. He calls,
yes,
calls the four U.S. carriers the four orifices.
We didn't want to go quite that far, Walt, but okay. But I'll assure the audience,
now we're talking about big content companies that do have to go through this kind of funnel. To get their stuff on devices that these devices, we all know, are really becoming little computers. And you guys have done a terrific job of providing a broadband class network now in this country. I mean, I don't know how many of you know this now, but there are, we are now ahead of Europe in terms of the speed, the data speed you can get coast to coast in the United States, largely under the leadership of Lowell and Verizon Wireless, although Sprint is catching up and Cingular will be there soon. But we're ahead. In Europe, the typical so-called 3G handset gets about, on an actual real throughput basis, about 200 kbps on a good day. And I just did another set of tests on the Verizon and the newer Cingular networks. And, you know, you can average 800, which is about where base level home wired DSL is. The question is, why shouldn't it be possible for someone with a great idea for a piece of software or delivery of content to be able to just sell it to me as a Verizon Wireless customer without getting your permission or cutting you in or negotiating where they are on the deck?
Yeah, I think this is an important point, and Peter alluded to it, and I think Mitch will probably pick up on this point as well. We want to get every money-making application we can on the deck. I mean, we just should say that up front. But if you don't have an application that plays well on a 2-inch by 2-inch or a 4-inch screen, the customer is not going to be happy. And the thing that we focus on to the exclusion of all else is the customer's experience. And if the customer buys that application, they've heard about it, they think it's cool, they looked at it on their PC, they want it on their handset, and it turns out to be a bust, what do? They go to the handset, the carrier, first and foremost. Can we? I also make a point. I think it can be win-win. We launched the chocolate phone here recently. We put Tetris on the deck. Mitch's folks worked with us to make sure it was a great experience. We had some music associated with that was special, and it was a great selling point for us.
Michael, I want to touch on another point that Peter raised, and that is the nature of the content we're going to watch on little screens.
It's always difficult to really predict how people are going to consume a new technology in terms of a conventional consumption pattern. And yes, every indication at the moment suggests that they're going to want it differently and shorter and more interactive, and I think that is conventional wisdom for the time being.
We've already been through, the video games are already, I think, one step more mature a content type on the mobile phone than perhaps video is. And so we've actually already been through this episode, and when we first started, the conventional wisdom was it was going to be boys. More or less like the conventional video game audience. It's going to be boys, they're going to want to play hardcore games, shooting, fighting, driving. Well, you know what? It didn't turn out that way. In fact, it turned out that it was more or less 55-60% women who played games on their mobile phones.
And these are more casual games.
They wanted to play casual games, more like the kind of games that people were playing for free on the internet, and they were willing to pay a small amount of money to play them on their mobile phone. So Tetris and Bejeweled and Solitaire and those kinds of games became extremely popular. And we really had to adopt a native design because people were not willing to use multiple key presses in order to play. So Zach Norman, who was one of the founders of Jamdat, used to say that he would encourage the designers to design games that could be played while walking.
It's fascinating.
Well, I'd say one of the fun things about this industry is that technology and applications are a little bit like the old slinkies. You know, the technology is now catching up, and we couldn't do anything more than a 1.3 megapixel camera until recently because the upload speeds were so slow. What would you do? It'd take you a half hour to upload the picture. Well, now we're at 3 megapixels, and you can do an hour-long video if you want to. I'm not suggesting you can upload an hour-long video, but
right.
You can certainly upload a 3-megapixel picture now. That opens up all sorts of capabilities, and as the screens evolve, then you can start to think about bringing down the TV shows and the full-length movies and those sorts of things and having a better experience.
There's going to be a painful couple of years, though, where that technology starts becoming ubiquitous.
Yep.
I mean, right, I sit in the green light meeting every Wednesday and look at the games that are on the slate, and we look at milestones. And I looked at a game last week where we were looking at a 64K executable version, and a 1.3 meg executable version of the same game. Now, you go tell your designer, you've got to make a game that's fun and playable and emotionally involving in 64K and in 1.3 megabytes of as the data footprint. So, you know, until we get those more effective and better phones spread through the channel more efficiently and more effectively, it's going to be painful. It's not so much the download, it's how much content can you put into a 64K footprint,
yeah.
Right?
I see.
You know, it's the experience that you're delivering to that user who can only see it through that little tiny prism of 64K.
And the next level up is that interactive stuff. And when Web-A comes and HSUPA, if you're a GSM guy, then you can really, that takes you to another level.
The upload
speeds really help.
Michael, this is not exactly about mobile phones, but it is about portable devices, and I can't resist because we've just had, if you look at the web and the newspapers this morning, it's all about this Apple announcement that they're beginning to sell movies, I guess today, with one movie studio, Disney. Those movies can be viewed on your Windows computer, your Macintosh, your iPod, and starting in January, they're going to sell a $299 little box that will let it all flow to your big screen TV.
Right.
So, is that a good thing for the movie business that a big player like that is getting into this business of selling movies as digital files, the way we've been doing with music and TV?
Yeah. No, I think it's good for lots of reasons. I mean, I think it's good because we've learned from the music business that unless you offer the consumer an alternative and a legal alternative to getting movies, they're going to pirate them. So whether it's Apple who's doing it or Amazon who's doing it or whoever's doing it, we want to encourage that. And I think it's good because if you look at sort of the history of the movie business, every time a new technological platform shows up that has consumer adoption, whether it's pay television or DVDs or whatever it is, we see a real growth in the value of our movies and in our library.
Although you do have a history of sometimes fighting those technologies at the beginning.
We sometimes, like children, fight what's good for us, yes.
So let's assume they're quite successful at this
right
movie thing. They announced yesterday that they had already sold 45 million TV episodes.
Yeah, I think they're selling them at like 1.5 million a clip.
It's like 9 or 10 months they've gotten up to that.
Yep.
So if they're successful, does that doom not only the DVD, but all this new Blu-ray and HD DVD stuff?
No, not for a very, very long time. I mean, the DVD business that we have at the moment is large. I think extremely large. I think there's a certain consumer behavior pattern that we see people going in on Tuesdays to Best Buy or Walmart and buying it. And I think that the DVD is one of those great inventions like the book that people just find incredibly useful. So I don't know that they're going to abandon it as quickly as everybody says they are.
It has leveled off. The DVD
it certainly leveled off. So did the book business level off. And everything levels off at a point. You know, growth can never be infinite. You know, I think that there will be adoption of the digital side of it. I certainly hope that there will be. I think what we've seen in the music business is that it takes always much longer for that to happen than people think it will. I think the HD question is a different question, and I don't know whether Steve Jobs has spoken to it, but I think generally, at least my understanding of it is that the digital delivery of our movies will occur in standard definition.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So
for now.
And for the foreseeable future. For one thing, I think because whether it's Amazon or Apple, they understand that it's a good thing to have two markets. But I also think that high-def discs or Blu-ray discs will have to have added features beyond just the resolution of the picture that will actually cause people to want those discs.
How big a problem, Mitch, is the standards problem on American phones?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, from our perspective, we've spent 5 years solving the problem in order to make our business really efficient. So, you know, we were talking beforehand, we released the FIFA World Cup product from Electronic Arts earlier in the summer on 2,000 handset, carrier, and language combinations. Just for a single franchise, it required 2,000 storekeeping units. But I think it's an interesting problem, because I think obviously we're a great supporter of standards because it'll make it a lot less expensive, and I think it'll improve the user's experience a tremendous amount. And so, you know, we fully support the drive to standardize the phone models, but I think there's a lot of resistance, much more than you would think, from the OEMs. The OEMs want to sell a highly differentiated...
Not the carriers.
No, it's not the carriers.
It's the
OEMs.
It's our advantage to have those standards as well. We can get to market much more quickly.
I want to go back to the OEMs for a minute, but aren't you Verizon a holdout, for instance? I mean, the other three major Soviet ministries here use Java. You use Brew, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
If you say it's to your advantage to have standards, why aren't you on the same standard everybody
else? That was a cost decision for us.
It was what?
That was a cost decision for us. We looked at the overhead that would be associated with having those kinds of applications, and we decided that we could move more quickly to Brew. Now, I know some people, you know, the whole Qualcomm setting the standards is an issue, and there is some overhead associated with that. But for us getting to market quickly and having one set of operating systems on the phone, that was a much better decision.
And would you ever support Java?
Sure.
Much broader and...
Yeah, absolutely. We have translators set up so that a Java game can run on a Brew operating system, and so we do some of that. It's not the major application for us because we get plenty of content through the Brew development.
Now tell me about the OEMs, the handset makers.
Well, I mean, you know, you think about the business from their perspective, they're trying to sell you a fashion accessory, right? They're not trying to sell you a computer that's going under your...
Some, it depends. Some do.
By and large, people are trying to sell you a fashion accessory.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the way that they market the Motorola Razr, the phones like that. So when you think about it from the perspective of the OEM, standardization is not their friend, because the more alike the phones are, the less likely you are to buy one of theirs as opposed to one of their competitors. So historically, they've really pushed for maximum differentiation.
I see we have what I hope is just the first audience question. It says, for games, what is the future of the user input interface buttons? Will we have to use the clunky mechanical buttons forever, or is there a better solution on the horizon?
I think we will have to use the clunky mechanical buttons. I mean, you have to approach this as, what's the principal use of the device? And right now, the principal use of this device is to make and receive phone calls. And entertainment applications are ancillary to that. Hopefully, they become more important, but at the time being, really, people are making and receiving phone calls on their phones, and the interface is pretty well optimized for making and receiving phone calls. And I think we as game makers have to really deal with that. And so I think the idea that we're going to sit around and hope for some peripheral or some change in the configuration of the keys, not a good bet.
Right. I mean, I would just observe that there has been a change in the hardware UI of a lot of phones. I think it's the first major change in a long time, and it's to put music and video transport controls, you know, play, pause, fast forward, and reverse on a fair number of phones. And that makes great sense, because doing that all through software on the screen is a pain in the neck. But to now try to emulate a game controller in hardware buttons with that limited amount of space...
Not going to happen.
I think the point here is we will go where the money is. So if we saw a lot of demand for something like that, who knows? You might be able to use a Bluetooth technology and have a little, some sort of a different interface, whatever it is, and still have an interface to the phone.
Okay, cool.
I agree with Mitch. It's not going to happen in the next, you know, four
Nokia
years.
Nokia tried it with the N-Gage. And
right.
Entirely successful.
How can mobile entertainment leverage location awareness? You want to talk about that, Lowell?
Yeah, location-based services is like a huge new frontier for us. We see it across, whether it's large business, all the way to medium business, down to the consumer side. So, you know, location-based awareness, the simple things are, on one of our phones, you can look at the navigation to work, and the content will automatically populate on a minute-by-minute basis if there's a traffic jam, and how to reroute you around the other way. I think it opens up other possibilities. Abilities like the advertising for a restaurant that's in an area, if you're searching for something like that.
But what does it have to do with mobile entertainment? Give me a location example.
There are kind of games of tag you could play with your mobile phone, where you have a target you have to find in a particular location. There are certain privacy and stalking kind of issues that we're going to have to deal with, as we've seen in some examples, some negative examples out of Japan, where it's actually quite a problem. The joke in our office is that the location-based revolution is 18 months away, and every 6 months it's 18 months away. So.
Well, thank you all very much,
thank you
all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very nice.